Welcome to the Did You Know Show with your host, Fred Hasse. I'm Ray, a physics teacher.
And I'm Holly, a Spanish teacher, the layperson of the group.
And we're joined by Fred. Hello, Fred.
Hello.
And Fred's background is in meteorology, and he also has a big interest in botany and all sorts of different science topics, and he's our expert. My background is in meteorology as well, and I am a physics teacher. So,
right.
All right.
The Did You Know Show is about science topics of all sorts, right?
Yep, and Fred, we've done meteorology-themed ones. We've done just general science ones. I don't think we've done any... We did one on trees once, didn't we, Fred?
That's correct. We had talked about the how trees can lift water over 400 feet.
Yep.
Oh, yes.
So we have hit a variety of topics, and this week's show is going to be about computer models and forecasting. So if you've ever wondered how meteorologists come up with what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day, well, we do rely heavily on the computer models, and that's what we're going to be focusing on today.
And check out show notes at dykshow.blogspot.com. We'll put up some links to helpful items.
Yep.
And about what we talk about. Also, you can email Fred at fredhasse@gmail.com. Hasse is spelled H-A-A-S-E. And email him with any questions or even show ideas.
And we can also be reached there as well.
Yes.
So we all have access to that email account. Should we... Oh, Fred, how is the... we should mention that the next show is going to be on the tropical cyclones, and we are in the middle of hurricane season. Fred, how's hurricane season going so far?
Well, for the Atlantic Basin, it's actually going a little above par.
Okay.
And however, we'll talk about it next week. But
yep.
Dust from Africa has kind of put a temporary pause on it, but that should clear out in about 4 or 5 days.
Interesting. And we'll talk more about that on the next show. So let's go ahead and jump into it on computer models. Fred, where do you want to get started?
Well, I think I'm going to start with the idea of writing equations, start with equations of motions that were derived back in the 19th century, and how that was leading up to that, and it was all the idea of programming those equations of motions and thermodynamic equations that led to the development of the computer model.
Okay. And I remember deriving many of those equations that the computer models are based on in my meteorology classes and my physics classes. So hopefully I'll have some familiarity with what you're talking about. So go ahead. What did you have in mind?
Well, I'm just going to start out saying that there was a couple of mathematicians, their names were Navier and Stokes, that derived the very first equation of motion for fluids, which has said that a acceleration of a piece of fluid following the fluid was a sum of the forces acting on it. And this was the very first step. However, the equation has no solution. and so it has to be only solved by approximations. But that had to wait until much later before people attempted to do this. And that was only the first step. Because there was also other equations that had to be added to this that affected the atmosphere. One of them was the gas law, which relates pressures and temperatures and density. And the pressures and temperatures and density all are important in determining the forces acting on a blob of air in the Navier-Stokes equation.
So suffice to say, it's not very simple. It's not something you'd want to do by hand.
Right. But believe it or not, it's been done by hand.
Okay.
You know, and I'm going to mention that they finally figured out the mathematics to write the first computer model, not done by a machine, but by somebody that was sitting down at a table with a pencil and eraser and just cranking away. But anyway, that goes a little bit soon. There is also... we had to write another type of equation to describe the latent heat of condensation. When water evaporates, it absorbs heat and leads to cooler temperatures than would otherwise be. And when water condenses, it actually releases heat so that the air will be warmer than usual. So that had to be added to it too, because that affected the temperature field, which affected the pressure field and so forth. And we just go on down the line like that. So there's your three equations that had to be fed in to do this. Now, and that's the way things stood at the beginning of the 20th century. In the 1920s, I forget the exact year, there was another fellow named Richardson. And Richardson was kind of a jack of all trades. He was involved in a whole lot of different things, including mathematics. And he was the first one to try to put those three equations I just described to you. And he put these equations on a grid and put all the weather observations he could find on Earth at various grid points throughout the world. And then he sat down and tried to figure out a 24-hour forecast by cranking it out all on hand using those three equations.
And how successful was he?
Well, and it took him 3 years to do a 24-hour forecast.
Oh, well, that's, my goodness.
That's not very practical.
But he was kind of one of these curious types. He just wanted to see if it could be done.
Yeah.
And finally, when he finished it, it was a mess. because he had like compression waves would work into the equation, because it turned out that the speeds of some of the systems and the grid spacing were very critical, and it had a tendency to amplify things that didn't need to be amplified. It would amplify compression waves, for example, so sound waves would end up dominating everything, and also some of the things you wanted to be figured out, like the wind field, it would fall apart and not very accurately computed. So that meant there was a lot of bugs to be worked out on the computer, to say nothing of speed.
Yeah, I was going to say, so it wasn't very accurate and it took a long time.
Right. But so that meant that it had to wait till digital computer was invented, and that couldn't be done. Although they had figured out how to, by using flip-flop circuits, they devised a digital computer. That the first working one was back in 1948, and it didn't even have the capability of your handheld calculator does today. And it occupied two floors of a building, and when they cranked it up, it would cause a brownout in the surrounding neighborhood.
So not very practical or useful for forecasting.
Right, and not only that, but also it was just a very unwieldy machine, but it
probably
was a
expensive
start.
To use as well.
Right. And of course, too, since they used these ordinary vacuum tubes like you used to in the old-time radios, and that produce an unbelievable amount of heat. So it was a very big power consumer. And so, but it did show it was able to do a few things. It could multiply and divide and subtract and simple things like that, but not much more than that.
Okay.
Anyway, but it had to wait till the transistor was invented before we could go to the next step. And, instead of using vacuum tubes, when the transistor was invented, in my opinion, the transistor was probably the greatest invention in the 20th century.
And many people would agree, I would think. A lot of engineers and science people would definitely be on board with that.
Right, because all the big chunks of the scientific advances, even things like our DNA project, you know, the genome project, would have been completely impossible without the invention of the transistor. And not only that, but now instead of a big, clumsy vacuum tube, which was maybe about 4 or 5 inches long and maybe an inch and a half wide, you could now get a transistor that was maybe a half inch or less long and maybe one or two millimeters wide. So now all of a sudden, it was now able to make a much more compact and durable system. For one thing, the transistors were more fail-safe than those old vacuum tubes were.
Yes, yep.
And they pulled a lot less. And, of course, too, the transistors got better and better. And then when finally it got reduced down when they invented the silicon chip, which carried the transistor idea all the way down to practically microscopic size. So now the big computers were now possible to build, design, and build by using little tiny microchips.
And for those of you that aren't familiar with, and probably there are a lot of people out there that aren't really sure what a transistor is, or for anybody that's even of my age and younger has probably never seen a vacuum tube, we will put links up in the show notes, probably to the Wikipedia articles that'll have pictures and a little bit more explanation on those technologies. So, all right, Fred, yeah. Continue on, because we can't get into what all the facets of that part of it, but.
Okay, but anyway,
we'll now, link to more
this kind of gives you the background, because now, with a very much greater speed that these microchips could do the computation, suddenly weather forecasting models were not again possible. The very first numerical model is what's called a barotropic model. And basically, what it did was ask the question is, if the atmosphere is simply allowed to coast, with no energy input or no energy subtracted for it, what will the weather systems, how will they move, and so forth. And that was our very first one. And so the barotropic model.
Yeah. About when was that was prevalent?
That was first started being used in the early 60s.
Oh, okay.
And, of course, that's oversimplified. Just let everything stay the way it is not how it works. That might be good for 3 hours or 6 hours or something, but if you're talking several days out, that would be no good at all.
Right. But it was a start, and it had various things. For one thing is that low-pressure systems in the upper levels during the winter would often drop down and stay in the southwestern United States for several days or even a couple of weeks on occasion. We call these cutoff lows, and the barotropic model was utterly unable to predict those.
Okay.
And so what barotropic model would end up doing in almost every case was move weather systems too fast.
Okay.
And there's no baroclinic input. In other words, it couldn't intensify anything, and it couldn't for that matter, it couldn't dissipate it either, except by spreading out that as you compute from one grid point to the next, because to compute a weather forecast on a grid system, every time you come up with a number at a grid, it influences the numbers nearby, and that effect is really to gradually smooth out the weather system. So if you let the barotropic model run long enough, you'll finally end up with the same answer everywhere. And so you can easily see that the barotropic model, the first step, was very limited, but it was a step. And it was pretty good for very short range forecasting.
Okay.
But still, most human beings, a good synoptic meteorologist, had no trouble beating the barotropic model in a forecast of what a weather system was going to do.
Okay, just by familiarity and seeing what the systems have done in the past.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, then came the first what you would call a baroclinic model. This uses temperature contrast, which is implicit that you can take a pressure surface, you go start at the ground, you go up a certain height above the ground, and the pressures will drop to a certain value, say P. And you go up to that pressure surface, P, everywhere, say, in the North America. And that would be one of the levels. Mm-hmm. Usually something like the 850 millibar surface or 700 millibar surface would be used. And then the second level would be higher up somewhere, say 500 or 300 millibars. So this was a two-level model. And the distances between those two surfaces is a measure of the temperature or density.
Okay.
The colder the air is, the closer the pressure surfaces would be to each other. And the warmer, the further apart they were. So now they cranked this out, and these were the very first baroclinic models, and they used it. And the amazing thing is in spite of their utter simplicity, they were able to predict the southwest cutoff low formation, although it did a lousy job at predicting when they move out and other things about it, but at least it could do that. That was a step forward.
Mm-hmm.
It was also able to develop weather systems and dissipate them.
Okay. So it was an improvement over the barotropic model.
Yeah, the original baroclinic model, the two-level model, had a serious weakness. It had a tendency to move weather systems too slow.
Okay.
Whereas you remember the barotropic model moved them too fast. So that actually became some value by using a combination of that you knew then that the real weather system would fall somewhere in between them so far as your speed goes. And so you, the barotropic model would give you kind of the outer limit how fast weather systems would move, and the original two-level model would give you the lower limit how fast things would move, and the real weather systems would fit somewhere in between.
Okay, so the forecasters could start to use both of them to get an idea of the time being somewhere in the middle.
Exactly.
Okay.
And of course, as computers got bigger and bigger with greater memory and so forth, that they were able to add more model levels. So finally, back in about 1970 or thereabouts, they came up with a seven-level model, which they call simply the baroclinic model, or sometimes they also call the aviation model. And this was the model from which our present big global model, the GFS, eventually evolved from.
Okay.
But every time they added more levels, you would gain more accuracy because you could begin to get more how the atmosphere, how the temperature field from the top to the bottom varies. In other words, it just isn't a single slab of atmosphere that you're looking at. Now you're looking at various layers of the atmosphere. You can allow for now warm air being on top of cold air and other such things. And of course, too, now they're adding to this the effects of the latent heat of condensation, heat input from the sun, and heat input or removal by the oceans and so forth. Now you could also add into it mountain ranges.
Okay.
But these were done very, the topography, and the mountain ranges, however, the grid spacing was much still, even at this time, was much too big to put in the individual mountains. So you put in just sort of a general mountain range, it's just a rip.
For those that don't know, Fred, you might want to explain a little bit what grid spacing is, because I know we mentioned it before. Do you want to briefly state what that is?
Okay, what that is that in the computer, you set up a mathematical grid like you have seen graph paper.
Yeah, graph paper. It's, yep.
Okay, on the graph paper, you see where the lines intersect each other, and each point is the grid point. And okay. In the abstract, when you're writing a program, you work with the grid system. And when you're doing the mathematical computations, you're taking differences from one grid point to the next grid point.
So if your grid points are really far together, instead of having the Rocky Mountains having lots of little peaks and valleys, it just kind of becomes one big blob of up.
Right.
Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's
so you don't get all the nuances and all the little gaps in the mountains and stuff like that. It's just like one big area that's higher, which isn't very accurate. So if the grid spacing is far apart, the mountain ranges might be represented, but just not real well.
And these early seven-level models, however, didn't always work very good. For one thing is it did not allow very good when an air mass is on, say, the Rockies up high. When it moves off the Rockies, the air heats up by compression, and it ends up a lot warmer than it was. And this affects how they move, affects the weather system. And really what it does, it slows down fronts that are moving, say, from the Rockies, off the Rockies. In the real case, it'll slow down or even stall out altogether. And our seven-level model was not very good at predicting that. It would show the front would just blast on through all the way to the East Coast, and whereas they'll tend to get stuck on the high plains in reality.
Okay.
So there was a lot of refinement need to be done. So all it needed to do, the mathematical equations had already been derived. So all we needed now is just to be able to increase the number of grid points in three dimensions.
Okay. Now at this point, what year about are we talking?
We're talking now about the mid, the late 70s, early 80s.
And we should mention all of this time through the 70s and 80s, the computer, the processing power is, you know, increasing significantly every year. So the computers are getting faster and faster. This point, is the grid spacing. Is it a processing power limit at that point in the early 80s, or is it a number of data point limitation?
It's really both.
It's both at that point. Okay. Okay, so at this point, the computers aren't quite fast enough, and we don't have enough data to really make it a lot better yet.
Right, and, okay. And so, yeah, so...
At that point... In fact, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to point out that even at this point, most of your good sound optic meteorologists still could beat the computer most of the time.
Okay.
So it could beat the newly grads or those meteorologists that are not very technically oriented. But otherwise, just about everybody else still, a decent meteorologist could still beat the computer.
So it's kind of like the computers that play chess, the programs, you know, for a long time they could beat the average player, but not the masters. And then eventually it could beat the masters, at least to a certain extent.
That's a good analogy. Also, see, the grid spacing also was important for another reason, is that to define small-scale weather systems like a thunderstorm.
Okay.
You have when the grid spacing is amounts to tens of miles apart, but the average thunderstorm cell is only about 5 miles in diameter, so there is no way at this stage a computer could handle thunderstorms.
Okay.
But thunderstorms are a very important cog in the energy conversion process in the atmosphere.
Okay.
And not only that, but it was at this stage not even able to handle tropical cyclones, hurricanes, typhoons, because they're very small systems, and you only could get about one or two grid points inside a hurricane, and it therefore just doesn't define it very well.
Okay. So what was the next advancement then?
Well, the next advancement was simply the memory power of the computer, so you could just stuff more grid points in. And now we go all the way to the late 90s, and now we got so many grid points, it can now predict tropical cyclones.
Okay. And at the point in the late 90s, or at some point we're in the late 80s. Okay. So we're in the late 80s. But at some point in the 90s, it no longer became a question of processing power or computer memory. It became a problem of data. Is that correct?
Exactly correct. Because the data comes in only from airports, under the larger airports at that, a few automatic stations, and pilot balloons or weather balloons that are launched only twice a day. So that is correct. So it is in the late 80s, this is when now the computer models became better than even your best meteorologist now.
Okay.
That was where it crossed over.
Okay.
And so,
now when you say, better, you're referring to like someone that they don't have access to the computer model,
or they have access to all the data that they want to use.
To see all the data, but they don't have access to the model.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're talking about computer model forecast versus a forecaster who can't see what the model's outputting, but just sees the current conditions and the past conditions. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Because obviously nowadays meteorologists, what we're saying about the computer versus meteorologist, meteorologists today, they always look at computer models when they're making their forecast. So they can, with the human input, they can be better than the model, but it's not really a fair fight because the model doesn't get to see what they're doing. It just, you know,
right.
You get to see what the other person did, you know, and then you get to, you know, modify it to however you'd like. So I just like to point that out when we're saying, because I think we might have confused some people, when we're saying the computer model is beating the person. That's the person without the aid of the computer model.
That's correct. I
Okay.
didn't mean to imply that. I mean, I thought
No,
that was implicit.
yeah, it was to me. I don't know, was it to you, Holly?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Well, then maybe we're okay with the listeners out there. All right,
However,
sorry.
though,
Continue on, Fred.
but even now at this stage, you know, now we're in the late 80s and early 90s, the models became quite were able to now predict tropical cyclone formation, but now, whereas before they couldn't even predict it whatsoever, now another problem popped up. They started over predicting them, and if the models were right, we would end up with something like about 40 hurricanes a year.
Whoa.
And so they had to figure out, you know, how to get around that problem of, you know, over predicting it.
Okay.
And not all of that, but now they got some models that are now have a close enough grid spacing to even predict thunderstorms. We got a model out now called a NOM model, which it evolved out of the what they used to call the Ada model, and it does a pretty good job of handling thunderstorms, even the outflow boundaries.
Oh, wow.
So, and what is interesting is that it was originally planned. They had a they wrote up a model which was written to update constantly, and it was going to update from aircraft. As aircraft took off and landed at the airports, they would be instrumented, and we would record temperature, pressure, and relative humidity as it climbed and as it came back down, and while they traveled, and they could input this data directly off the airplane into this model. This model was called RUC, RUC.
And it's still around, but they
Right.
didn't implement it fully, correct?
The model was implemented, but the idea behind it never was that they were supposed to start the instrumentation of the aircraft back in 97, but it fell apart. That the Congress and the White House decided it was too expensive, and it never happened. So while the RUC model still is being used, its ability to rapidly update itself, that's what RUC stands for, a rapid update.
Cycle, right?
Right, but its ability to update rapidly was hampered by the fact that this aircraft was never instrumented.
Yeah, and that could have been extremely beneficial.
Yes, it could have been. To say the least, it would have been especially valuable in predicting thunderstorm formation, squall line formations, and these little mesoscale, what they call mesoscales, it's a small scale weather system that can be very severe.
Yes. Now, some states have like mesonets where they've put up a whole bunch of observations. Does that
That's
get fed into the models, Fred?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so there are some places where they have way more observations than others, and I would think that as we get more and more of those mesonets across the country, if it's possible, the models will get better and better.
Now, but there's only one problem so far, though. Those mesonets measure just the surface data.
Oh,
Now,
and
they
that's
have
true.
radar.
That's
The
true.
Doppler radar can compute the upper winds to some extent. The Doppler radar is capable of measuring the wind speeds either toward or away from each radar set.
So as more and more radars get deployed, that'll be helpful as well. And that'll happen just as population increases, one would think. Also, Fred, is data from satellites fed into the models as well?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's mo and in this case, it's mostly the IR data. They can measure things like sea
Infrared.
surface temperatures down to a fraction of a degree, and they also can measure surface temperatures from, you know, just the ground from wherever it is, so you don't have to have a city there.
And the nice thing, of course, about the satellite, like you're saying, you don't have to have any people there and you can still get data.
Right, but of course, the weakness of the getting weather data with the satellite is, of course, clouds.
Yes.
Because then, whatever the cloud top is, you can compute the idea of the atmosphere temperature field all the way down to the tops of the clouds, and then that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing below that. So that's the weakness of it. But it does fill in a good percentage of the data blank areas. And of course, it's been really useful now at computing things like sea ice coverage in the Arctic and Antarctic, and snow cover, and sea surface temperatures down, like I said, to a fraction of a degree.
And all that stuff goes into the model. The snowpack, yes, the ice, and the sea surface temperatures, all that goes into the model. So
right, every single day.
Yep.
So that now the models also can allow for such things as the change of the albedo or reflectivity. Like, for example, that suppose you got some bare ground, say, in Canada, and then all of a sudden a big snowstorm comes up, and now you got a snow cover, and snow has a very high albedo, meaning it reflects something like 85-90% of the sunlight, whereas bare ground maybe has only 30% albedo. So that makes it's very important in determining how warm or how cold the air can get.
And the models take that into account, especially then. That's good. What else do we have here about the models, Fred? Oh, Holly, do you have a question?
Yeah, I had a question. So who runs the computer models? In other words, who houses the computers that do this, and who tracks the data, that kind of stuff? And then is it available for free to everybody else? I mean, is it the U.S. government or private companies?
Or first of all, there's several different global models are now working. We got they're run by our government, in Suitland, Maryland. We got the big computer that runs three of the models.
Okay.
And the military runs their own models. They got the Navy's model, which is called NOGAPS, and the Air Force even has their model. So how many does that add up to? Something like, what, five models right there.
Right.
And some of the stuff is available, Fred, for, like, if you wanted to run your own version of whatever, if you get the data and you run it, with your parameters set and different, settings at the start, I believe that the general public can do that as well, can't they?
They sure can, yeah. And they already do it.
Yeah. Because I remember back when I was in college, we were doing some research, and we would get the data. We would do like a different run, instead of the standard one, we would flip some switch, and you get completely different output from the model. So same model with just a different initialization, turning up the importance of something or flipping something on or off, that type of thing.
Or like eliminating the snow cover.
Yes, that kind of thing. Yeah, or the getting rid of the vegetation, that kind of stuff. So.
Now, is the, let's say, like, the TV weatherman is, or weatherwoman, are they interpreting the output of the models themselves, or are they interpreting somebody else's interpretation of the models?
The latter, really, because a lot of these TV stations are scared to death of a lawsuit, and so they pretty much follow the weather. The National Weather Service line.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say that when I watch the TV stations, 9 times out of 10, if there's a new forecast from the National Weather Service and you watch the person on TV, it is 90% the same as what the National Weather Service just said. I have seen exceptions. Certainly every time around here when they go for snowfall totals, there's always one that goes way against what the National Weather Service does. But overall, they do play it pretty close to the vest. And if you're looking for a forecast, the first place to go is the National Weather Service.
Right. And so, however, the model output is available to anybody that has a PC.
Yep. Oh, okay. And we'll put some links. Fred, you can send me a couple and we'll post them. We can put some links to some places where you can look at model data from the various. It's not called ADA anymore, Fred. What's it called again?
It's called NAM, NAM.
And it's not even the GFS anymore, is it?
What is GFS it? Is still GFS.
GFS is still GFS, okay.
and believe it or not, that old NGM model still exists.
We used to call that the no good model.
I don't know anyone that pays attention to it anymore, but it exists for whatever reason.
That's interesting.
Now, What is interesting now is that the United States and our military are not the only people that are running global models. The Canadians have their own global model.
Yep.
The Japanese do. The English do, call UK Met.
Yeah, I remember looking at the Canadian one, of course, and UK Met, the United Kingdom one. So.
And then they have the medium, the Center for Medium Range Forecast, weather forecast model put out in Brussels.
So there's lots out there to look at.
Does the National Weather Service take any of that into account?
Yes, they do.
They do. And okay.
In fact, in their discussions, when they prepare like a 6-day forecast, they'll say something like the GFS implies this, and the European model implies that, and then they put weights on during certain weather situations as to which model is more believable, and sometimes they'll even go ahead and say the European model is the superior model in this situation, and then sometimes they'll say the RGFS is the better model.
And usually some sort of blend or consensus of the models ends up being the best forecast over a long period of time. Is that still true?
Right. That's still true, and it changes daily too. I mean, at one time they'll say, and our medium range forecast is 60% based on the GFS, and 30% based on the Euro model, and 10% based on the Canadian model, and so forth.
I have an additional question. When I go to the National Weather Service website and type in my zip code, and then I get a forecast, is that somebody, did somebody sit down and do a forecast specifically for my zip code, or is, what is that?
Yes, yes.
Yes, okay.
They do zones. Okay. Right, Fred?
Yes, yes, and I was going to add, too, is that you might have that, but you can also get a hold of a print from the computer that actually predicts the weather for various cities throughout the U.S.
Okay.
And they use both the NOM model, the GFS, and the NGM still has its output too. Like I say, I don't know why we even hang on to it for, since it's been far eclipsed.
All right. Well, anything else, Fred, with the models?
Well, that should pretty much cover it, because otherwise we can, try to just talk about, get more technical and talk about things like the Nyquist frequency and so forth, but that gets that's kind of beyond the scope, I think, a little
yep,
bit.
That's fine. I think I'd just like to reiterate that, as for people out there that aren't that familiar with meteorology, a meteorologist's job, they're not just regurgitating the models. They really do have to look at multiple models and in certain situations figure out which one's more likely to be right. And it is, it is definitely a skill. It's something that takes practice. And if you have knowledge of how the models work and you understand the physics behind everything that's going on, it makes you much, much, much better at forecasting, because you know what, where the model's going to go wrong, or you know where the model can't handle this situation that well, et cetera, et cetera. So it really takes, a good forecaster isn't just somebody that looks at the models every day. It's somebody that looks at the models every day, looks at what happens every day, and then also knows all the stuff that's going on, physics-wise or thermodynamic-wise behind the scenes. They understand why things happen the way they do. And those have been the people that I've seen that are the best forecasters. So,
weather forecasters, I think, are notorious for being wrong, or else they take a lot of flack for it. Where would you say maybe there needs to be improvements in the models, or?
Let me jump in real quick. I think actually most forecasters, at least out to 3 days, do a pretty darn good job. I think it's the question of what the public expects and what the public can understand.
Right.
If we were able to do real percentage-based forecasts to let them know our confidence in items, and the public understood percentages, which I think we talked about it on a show before, if the public understood what that meant, and the listeners of the show now do, I think there'd be a lot less of this, oh, they're wrong. I think the problem really stems from the fact that
the public is too dumb.
The television stations and the newspaper do dumb it down, mm-hmm. and they just say rain or no rain, and it's not that simple. You know, it's just not that simple. It's way more complicated than that. You know, you have a certain confidence of no rain or rain, but, you know, it's that the public wants a yes or no. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock, will it be raining where I'm standing? And that's just not the way it works.
And because it's made so simple every day, we just expect that you should know.
Yes.
You know, a yes or no answer.
Yes. Yeah. Fred, did you have anything to add to that?
Not really. That pretty much sums it up in in a sense, now that I think about it, is that probably it would have been more logical to combine our discussion on probability forecasting with this model discussion. You know, one follow the other.
Yeah.
It would dovetail in better.
So if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to the earlier podcast, go back and check out the one on probability. So.
Right. And by the way, the computer even works it out that way, too. They got computer, they compute probabilities in the computer for your area.
Yep.
And in fact, as they got it down to the point where across the city of Houston, like, for example, Hobby and Intercontinental Airport will have slightly different precipitation probabilities and even different temperatures. That's getting pretty good. Pretty precise.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, that was it for computer models. I even learned a couple things, too, about the really early ones and people doing it by hand, which I can't even imagine, and taking 3 years to do 24-hour forecasts. It seems crazy. Our next show will be on tropical cyclones and, you know, the hurricane season and that stuff, which is very relevant right now as we are near the peak. Is that correct, Fred?
That's correct.
Okay. Check out
the show notes at dykshow.blogspot.com. We'll put a bunch of links up.
Yeah, there'll be a lot today.
Yes.
A lot of links.
And then also you can email us at fredhaase@gmail.com. Haase is spelled Haase.
I'm Ray, physics teacher.
I'm Holly, a Spanish teacher.
Fred. Goodbye, Fred.
Goodbye, and
until next
Fred.
Time. Yep. Until next time.